All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on this Monday morning. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Monday morning movie reviews are coming up as well. We're also going to talk about some of the best opening scenes in movies. Pulp Fiction opened this week in 1994, if you can believe that, how long ago that was. We're going to talk about some weird sports superstitions and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me to talk about the Monday morning movie reviews. This week, they're going to be doing all the heavy lifting because I didn't leave my apartment for 4 days because I was sick. So these guys are going to be handling all the movie reviews. So let's bring Eric in. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's say hello to Steve. Steve?
Hello. I'm here.
All right, good. Everybody's here. All right. So the Monday morning movie reviews, you guys are going to handle it all because I have I was sick.
You had a bad weekend.
Oh.
I would say you had a good weekend, this particular weekend.
I understand. I understand. Wow, man, I just knocked me on my butt. This was terrible. So, anyway, I'm still not 100%, but I'm better than I was. I can tell you that. Anyway, let's get to some of these movies here. Steve, what about The Woman Who Loves Giraffes?
Yeah, this is a little something that's at the Gene Siskel Film Center right now. Several years before Jane Goodall went into the jungle to study primates, a 23-year-old Canadian woman named Anne Innes Dagg traveled alone to South Africa to begin what would become her lifelong study of giraffes in their natural environment, a passion that began with her as a child and led her down a path that included a lot of roadblocks, most of them put up by men, ultimately made her the world's foremost authority on giraffes. And this documentary by Allison Reed is compelling and uplifting, and it takes us through her life and her struggles and her triumphs that she faced on this road to becoming a successful researcher and author. She penned a book that is still considered to be basically the Bible for giraffe researchers. She was a teacher, wife, mother, and ultimately a feminist icon. The number of very basic things that were denied her in her efforts to return to Africa in the decades since her initial visit, simply because of her gender, is sort of an embarrassment to higher education and scientific study. She was repeatedly denied tenure at a university she was teaching at, even though she had dozens of published papers and earned a doctorate and had a book. It wasn't until more recent years, as interest in giraffes has expanded because their numbers are dwindling, that she was pulled back in by a younger generation of researchers that kind of worship her writings. They invited her to speak at conferences and eventually got her back to South Africa, where she sort of picked up where she left off and discovered that a lot of her early findings were not correct. And she did something that almost never happens in the scientific community. She went back and fixed her original text, because they were some mistakes, and I guess that doesn't happen very often. There's a tremendous amount of really great archival footage, most of which that Dagg shot herself in 1956, but more revealing are these sort of photographs and letters from her first visit. The letters are actually read by actress and fellow Canadian Tatiana Maslany, and most of those letters are to her soon-to-be husband at the time. It's sort of just really heartwarming to watch her back with these giraffes, and it's genuinely moving, long overdue. She revisits locations where she worked 60 years ago, and her enthusiasm hasn't waned a bit. The film is an inspiration, but it also doesn't spare those who deserve criticism for their limited ideas about women in the field and in the classroom. It has a strong message about conservation, too, obviously, and obviously more footage of these strange and majestic creatures than you're ever going to see in one place, so I highly recommend it. And like I said, it's playing through the week at the Gene Siskel Film Center.
Okay, that's The Woman Who Loves Giraffes. All right, cool. All right, Eric, let's talk about El Camino, a Breaking Bad story.
Yes. This is actually a follow-up now to the Breaking Bad, the conclusion of the Breaking Bad series, basically an epilogue that Vince Gilligan, the creator of the show, wrote and directed, and is playing exclusively on Netflix currently. And it follows what happens when, sorry for people who have not binged Breaking Bad up to this point, but so there'll be a little bit of spoilers here, but the film pretty much begins where the finale ended, where Jesse Pinkman, played by Aaron Paul, has escaped his captors and is on the run, while pretty much everyone else that he's associated with, nearly everyone, is dead. So as he's on the run, trying to escape, not just, you know, anyone who might be left from the gang that captured him, as well as the authorities, we basically get sort of a retread, sort of revisiting, not just, you know, some of the surviving members of the cast, but also, going back in time and sort of filling in blanks throughout the show, notably, his time in captivity. The first hour of the film is sort of, filled with, a lot of, the whole movie is filled with a lot of flashbacks and extended ones. You know, a lot of time spent with Jesse Plemons' really sort of sociopathic, psychopathic character that was one of his captives. And, you know, sort of getting a sense of what Pinkman went through. And because this is a story that is, you know, as you mentioned Pulp Fiction earlier, is also, you know, also very much about the redemption of this character. You know, Jesse Pinkman and Walter White, some might say, were, you know, unworthy of redemption, and you know, sort of picking up where Pinkman left off and thinking about everything that he was associated with during this entire series, you might think that he might not exactly be a candidate for our sympathies, but he was. He grew into that over time. And this, you know, this last sort of period in his life where he was captured, we really get that fleshed out here in this movie, and we really kind of get the sense that he's kind of done his time, basically. He's sort of, you know, created this penance by, you know, all these horrible deeds that he had done are basically sort of purged out of him through this captivity, and it builds very much like the film itself kind of feels like bonus episodes of the show. Just a lot of stuff, individual situations, particularly some of the flashbacks, feel like standalone episodes that we might have missed during the 6-season run of the show. But it really does build very well. I think the first hour kind of feels a little bit more episodic, but as this film sort of reveals Jesse's journey and leading up to some very tense stuff that happens in the second half of this movie, we really do get sort of a really nice bit of fan service that Vince Gilligan has given us. Aaron Paul is really terrific in this movie, and we get to revisit some of the characters that we love, some that didn't make it to the end of the series. Some of them reappear, many of them reappear in cameos, including the late, great Robert Forster, who has a very key role in this film. And the couple scenes that he has in this movie is just a heartbreak unto itself, just seeing just what kind of character actor he was, how he could command scenes in just a couple minutes and say so much through silences as well. So I'm you know, El Camino is definitely, you have to have seen the series to really have an appreciation of this movie. So don't really go into it thinking otherwise. It's not so much a standalone movie as it is a continuation of the series, and I think fans will mostly be very pleased with it.
Okay, and that's playing on Netflix, right?
Yes.
All right, El Camino, Breaking Bad movie. I have not caught up on Breaking Bad, so I'm gonna have to, I think, wait on this one before I check it out. But I really always liked Aaron Paul. I think he's a terrific actor. So, all right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress and Steve Procopi are here, and we're reviewing the new movies on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. We'll do box office as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text, and more movie reviews right after this. right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline Studio in downtown Chicago here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about box office as well and some weird sports superstitions. And we'll look back in history. 1994, Pulp Fiction opened. We're going to talk about that and some of the best opening scenes in movies. All of that and more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And it is the Monday Morning Movie Reviews with Eric and Steve. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, Steve, let's talk first. You know, you mentioned Eric just mentioned Robert Forster. And you the music box of horrors is happening, and you guys are actually going to show Alligator, and that was already scheduled, right?
Yeah, we that's next weekend. It starts Saturday, October 19th at noon, and it's just a 24-hour. We do it every year, 24 hours of just nothing but, like, the most wonderful face-melting horror things. A few familiar titles, but a lot of also really rare things that don't get screened very often. And it just so happened we had Alligator lined up. Now, you have to be a diehard to see it because it's at 3:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written by John Sayles, so there's actual like greatness involved other than just, and it's a rare lead performance from Robert Forster. So I hope people, I mean, I know the thing's going to sells out every year, but I have a feeling people are going to stay awake for that one. And I think it's going to be just a really wonderful way to celebrate. And we've also, it's weird because the last film we're playing is the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which was meant to just be like a fun way to cap everything off, but in sort of a tribute to Luke Perry, who's one of the leads in that, but then also after we booked it, Rucker Hauer died, who's also in that film, so it is. There's a lot of recently deceased people represented this year. That's fine. That's how we're glad we can accidentally be this timely. But I'm really looking forward to the lineup this year for sure.
Well, what are some of the other ones? What are you guys showing?
We've got we're opening with we usually open with a silent film. This year it's The Man Who Laughs, which I'm pretty sure we booked this before we knew Joker was playing it in 70 at the Music Box, but it is, if you've ever seen the character in that film, you know that it is clearly the visual reference point for Joker from the comic books.
Yeah.
And we have two guests this year. We have a filmmaker named John Hancock, who made a great film called Let's Scare Jessica to Death. We're playing that fairly early. It's like the third film of the day at 3:45. And then later on Saturday, we're playing Dog Soldiers, which is the first feature from Neil Marshall, and he's coming in as well. Neil Marshall is just, I think, one of the real greats of the horror genre, and forgetting for a minute that he made this most recent Hellboy. But yeah, I mean, I just think his work, I've met him a few times before, I think he's great, and I'm really looking forward to people seeing that on the big screen, because I'm guessing, I don't think it really played that widely in Chicago. We're like toward the end, we're playing like Halloween 2 and The Fly 2 and Demons 2, so we've got like Bava represented. It's a cool, and we've even got like, and almost everything is screening in 35 millimeter. I think we have one 16 millimeter. I think Let's Scare Jessica to Death is actually 16 millimeter. We have one movie called Retribution that I've never seen before that is actually the director's personal print because we couldn't find any other. So yeah, it's just like this wonderful exercise of going through the familiar and the weirdly unfamiliar.
Mm. All right,
and there's like tons of vendors and food trucks stop by at all hours, and so yeah, it just becomes like a big party by the end.
There you go. Music Box of Horrors. I've made it through a few weekends at the Music Box as part of that. So that sounds like a great thing. And to see to see Alligator on the big screen again, man. You know, I love that movie. I that movie is just fantastic. And got a great sense of humor. Lewis Teague directed it, who would go on to direct Cujo. So that's good stuff. So get your Music Box of Horrors, and you can check out the Music Box website for more information and complete schedule and all that good stuff. All right, cool. Okay, Steve, tell us about Pain and Glory.
Oh, okay. This is
this is Almodovar, right?
Yes, yes. No, this is a journey of an aging filmmaker coming to terms with his legacy and his history of relationships and even his body that is sort of breaking down during the course of the film, in a career that spans back to the late 1970s. Spain's Pedro Almodovar has delivered dozens of films that sort of add up to a really impressive portfolio, films that tell very bold stories in very bold ways using colorful production design and live music and stories about strong women and sexuality and seriously, even just storyline issues that if any American director, I don't think any American director would ever tackle so regularly. But Pain and Glory is something much more introspective than I'm used to even from him, and he's made movies about his mother before. So this filmmaker in this story, Almodovar, I should say, takes his own life and career as an inspiration for a character named Salvador Malo, who's an aging auteur played by Antonio Banderas, who we used to work with pretty regularly and hasn't worked with in quite a while. He's struggling with a bunch of health issues. Just as interest in his first film happens around the anniversary of its release, and he's sort of reminded of the film's impact when it first hit screens, and he finds himself getting very nostalgic about many things in his life, including the actor that starred in that film, with whom he did not get along with very well at the time and has been estranged with ever since. But it also makes him think about his own childhood and growing up in poverty as an only child. And there is some discussion about whether, you know, there has been some discussion since the film premiered about whether the actor in the film, the character of the actor, is actually supposed to be Banderas, because it's clear that Banderas is playing Almodovar. It's all very meta and very cool. Honestly, this is maybe the best thing I've ever seen Antonio Banderas do, and I tend to like his performances in most things. And he's sort of looking back at his life and what it has added up to this point. He's had his back injuries that required surgery, and the commitment to like the physical demands of this role are just as incredible as the emotional demands. Every movement seems considered and deliberate, and it's meant to look very painful. And he just really, really shines and allows us some glimpses of emotional anguish that he navigates on top of the physical torment. So he gets together with this actor, and they discuss the possibility of going to this Q&A screening, and they fight, but they also do really hard drugs. and it turns out that these hard drugs, which the director doesn't usually use, are actually really helping with the pain. So that kind of adds to everything going on in this film. There's also another character who shows up late in the film named Federico, who turns out to have been the person he thinks he first ever really truly loved, like years and years ago, and he just happens to be in the same town as him, and they reunite briefly and just for a night to talk and catch up, and it's a really poignant scene. It almost feels like a separate movie, but it's actually really beautiful and fits in really nicely. Some of the best stuff involves these flashbacks into Salvador's childhood and his doting mother, who's played by Penelope Cruz, who is also someone that Almodovar has worked with many times before. We learn about their move to this coastal city where his father found the family a small home, which is basically a glorified cave. There's discussion of sending this kid to a seminary school. There's an encounter with a local teenager that this little boy has that he's tutoring to learn
okay,
to
Steve,
read.
Steve, hang, yeah. on, hang on for a second.
Sure.
We got to take a quick break. When we'll come back, we'll talk more about Pain and Glory, which is Almodovar's new movie, and we'll get more thoughts on that right after we break here on 720 WGN.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And, yeah. And we are also going to be talking about weird sports superstitions and some of the best opening scenes in movies and all kinds of really cool stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. 312-981-7200. It's also Monday morning, and that means Monday morning movie reviews. And we're in the middle of those right now. Steve and Eric join me every Monday morning to review the movies. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, Steve, you were continuing about Pain and Glory.
Yeah, just to wrap it up, like I said, these flashbacks to this when this director was a little boy, and he has one very important one that has to do with him sort of becoming aware of where his physical attractions lie. Nostalgia can very easily, and especially in film, easily warp into sort of self-indulgence and feel like you're falling into a rut. But in Pain and Glory, Almodovar avoids this trap very easily and instead delivers a story of reflection and the passage of time. As anyone with decades behind them and certainly as an artist can appreciate, this is a stunning piece of filmmaking. And like I said, Banderas, I don't think has ever been better. And his performance here is one I could watch over and over again. And so it not only makes this one of Almodovar's best films, but I think one of the year's best films.
Okay. All right. It's playing in three theaters. It's at the River East. It's at the Landmark Century and at in Evanston, the Century 12 in Evanston.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's playing. Okay. Pain and Glory. All right. Eric, why don't you tell us about Dolomite Is My Name?
Okay. We talked about this briefly from the Toronto Film Festival, so I'll recap this for the new audience. But this is the story of Rudy Ray Moore. People who are not familiar with Rudy Ray Moore, he was a struggling comedian back in the 1970s, did a lot of stage warm-ups for acts and nightclubs and things like that, and really wanted to make it bigger. And he started doing that by coming across these local folk tales told through limericks, basically, and began telling these stories live through a character he created called Dolomite. And this would lead to him creating will be called party albums, these dirty albums, that he was selling on the streets, basically, became big hits within, the African American community. And then he wanted to take it a step further, and develop a movie, around the Dolomite character. Rudy Ray Moore in the movie is played by Eddie Murphy, this is quite the return of Eddie Murphy. This is the Eddie Murphy that we really grew to love back in the 1980s. This is sort of the perfect fit between actor and character, in this case a real-life character. The movie was directed by Craig Brewer. It was written by Larry Kazanowski and Scott Alexander, who basically created a niche in film of creating these crazy, true life biopics, mostly centered around filmmakers, people like Ed Wood, we had People vs. Larry Flint, The Disaster Artist, amongst others, People vs. O.J. Simpson miniseries, and they wrote this one as well, and this one fits right into that wheelhouse, and as the characters so often say throughout the film, basically give the audience what they want, and anyone coming into this movie who even has even just an inkling of who Rudy Ray Moore was are going to get exactly what they want out of this film. This is a really funny, very sweet film with a tremendous cast, not just Eddie Murphy, Wesley Snipes, just killing it in this film. It's a great return for him. and you know Craig Robinson's in it, and you know just a whole bunch of Keegan-Michael Key plays the serious playwright who ends up writing the Dolomite film, and most of what they actually film in the movie is mostly the Human Tornado. It's mostly scenes from that movie that we see, even though it's referred to as Dolomite. But this is probably like one of the sweetest films you will ever see, with the number of times they actually say a 12-letter swear word as often as they do it throughout the movie. This movie, it's in theaters now. It'll be there for a couple weeks, and then it will be making its debut on Netflix, which, you know, any chance you can get to see this movie with an audience would be quite a thing. But you know, if you have to wait for a couple weeks for Netflix, it is absolutely worth your time. It is a lot of fun.
Okay. All right. What did you think, Steve?
I think this is great. And Eric's right. See it in a theater, but good luck finding it in a theater, at least around Chicago. Because there are things about this film that, like, demand just show you how beautifully made it is, from the production design to the costumes by Ruthie Carter, who just won an Oscar for doing costumes for Black Panther. The cinematography is gorgeous. He just sort of makes every scene pop with these really warm colors. It would be a shame if you didn't at least try to make the effort to see this film on the big screen. It doesn't hit Netflix for a couple weeks, but I got to say, Eric's right. There are definitely points, especially in the second half, and we should make it clear, this is not just about the making of this film. This is about this guy's career. It's not a life story, but it's like basically from when he first hit it big as a comedian to like every sort of the very natural progression, it feels like, into making this film. But it does feel, parts of it do feel, like once we get to the making of it, does feel a lot like The Disaster Artist, and that's not a criticism at all. There are just some really hilarious behind the scenes exploits. Honestly, you almost watch Eddie Murphy and you go, why hasn't he done, like, why? This feels like something that should have happened 20 years ago. And maybe it took meeting someone like Craig Brewer, who has sort of a history of making these very blaxploitation-ish films like Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan. And he's also doing the Coming to America sequel with Eddie Murphy. So maybe he needed to meet that guy to really feel comfortable making this movie. But it's like a return to his R-rated roots. And make no mistake, this is about as R-rated as you can get right now. But I also love the idea that this is not just like a making fun of the making of this film and how much of an amateur production it was. This is about like a guy who was driven, and he like had a complete, well-conceived vision for what he wanted to create, and more importantly, who he wanted to create it for. He felt like his community was being underserved by Hollywood, and he wanted to make something that kind of checked all the boxes for them. And it was a risk that could have broken him financially and spiritually, but like anyone who knows their film history knows that's not what happened. And this ended up making something that audiences of every conceivable color connected with and still celebrate. So I think this movie is terrific, and I hope people actually check it out in the theaters.
I can't wait to see it, because I mean, I love Dolomite.
Mm-hmm.
And Rudy Ray Moore, man, is the man. And this is like the perfect storm for Eddie Murphy to play this role. You know what I mean? I can't think of anybody else who should play this part but him.
I think this is actually the best thing he's done since Bowfinger, which then this movie shares a lot in common with that movie. I mean, that would actually make a perfect double feature.
Yeah. God, I haven't seen Bowfinger in a long time. I love that movie.
Yeah, we should also call out, and of course I wrote it down and now I can't find it, the actress who plays Lady Reed, whose name is Divine Joy Randolph, because she steals like every scene. And not just that, and she's not trying to, she's just got like a beautiful singing voice, and she ended up becoming like his sidekick on the road when he was doing stand up and man, but just he just has a partnership with her that I loved. Like, I love the sensibility of that and how he kind of checked himself with her and she sort of talked to him about her insecurities. It's a great, great role, and I guess she's either won a Tony or had nominated for a Tony recently, I've never seen her. I've never seen her in anything before, so I was like, oh, I need to see more with her.
Got it. All right.
Yeah, so she's really good.
Dolomite is my name. All right, you guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric, Steve, we're going to hang on. We're going to come back, and we got more movies to review right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on WGN on a Monday morning. And the Monday morning movie reviews are continuing, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday. And lots of stuff happening here on the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And we've got Eric and Steve here to review the movies. Let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Steve, why don't you tell us about Gemini Man?
Oh, okay. So the latest from director Ang Lee is Gemini Man. And it actually is based on a screenplay that's been bouncing around Hollywood for more than 20 years. But apparently it wasn't until now that the special effects technology that would basically be necessary to make this film were available. To put things into context, I think one iteration of this movie was going to star Clint Eastwood. And the screenplay, the current screenplay, combines work from David Benioff from Game of Thrones, one of the creators there, Billy Ray, who I know you know, Nick,
yeah.
and Darren Lemke. Gemini Man stars Will Smith as Henry Brogan, an assassin for hire, usually by the government, who is ready to retire. But then he finds out that the person that he killed on his final job was a scientist who, as far as he could tell, posed no threat to the free world or national security. And he gets curious and attempts to find out why this guy was targeted and why he needed to die and who ordered the hit. And as his investigation progresses, he himself becomes a target of someone named Clay Varys, who's played by Clive Owen, a man whose organization seems to believe only in weaponizing all technology. As a result of some of Varys' projects, both the scientist and now Henry have to be taken out. So Henry becomes a man on the run. And he's assisted by an agent named Danny, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who was hired at first to survey Henry's activity during his retirement passively, and now she's saving him from a large number of assassins who aren't quite as good as Henry, except for one, whose name is Junior, and just happens to be, and I don't think this is a spoiler because it's been in like every trailer, he's a clone of Henry, who's about half his age and has been trained practically from birth to be this perfect killing machine. Will Smith plays both roles, and from what I understand, the younger version is in fact a full CG face replacement and not like a de-aging, the current version of Will Smith, like is popular with some other movies right now. The results are fairly astonishing just from a special effects perspective. Junior doesn't understand that he's a clone. The younger Henry indeed looks like a slightly bulkier Fresh Prince, but without the facial hair. And while you may actually get distracted by the overall impact of two Will Smiths frequently in the same shot and fighting each other, the effects are mostly seamless. I did notice some weird issues, sort of coloring outside the lines in moments where they're in broad daylight, but, there are some individual set pieces, action set pieces that are strong, including an early motorcycle chase between the two Smiths, but when the two guys actually start conversing, the wind is kind of yanked right out of the whole thing. And even in the moral discussions about the ethics of cloning, they seem obligatory and don't really set the world on fire with any deep thought. Smith does a credible job of playing this dual role. The older guy is sort of even-tempered and more cerebral, and then the younger guy is following orders and training, and but he's still sort of a youthful hothead and lets his emotions get the best of him. Winstead is sporadically allowed to contribute in both the thinking and the fighting portions of the plot. Clive Owen kind of holds up in his lair for most of the film, wringing his hands and scheming like villains do, so he doesn't really contribute that much. Gemini Man is basically a huge misstep for both Smith and Lee, and even if the special effects turned out exactly as planned, as far as I know they did, that doesn't really save the movie from coming up short and feeling way too conventional. Smith is sort of built of natural charisma and charm, but the days of that being enough to sustain a two-hour film are long behind him. I wouldn't call the film a complete wash, but it is definitely a flawed piece of work, so I am not recommending it.
All right, Eric, what did you think?
I'll go a step further. I don't think Ang Lee has made a worse film than this, I think that this movie is beyond a wash, because seemingly the only thing this movie has going for it is its ability to show off the latest version of this technology, which, frankly, is we've been seeing for the better part of 12, 13 years now. Yes, it was certainly sloppy and distracting at first, but it has been getting noticeably better. Marvel has certainly, taken advances in it. And, you know, of all the people that I want to see, you know, two of in a movie, one of the last people on that list is actually Will Smith, who does something remarkable in this movie. He gives two bad performances. Because the thing is that Will Smith, it just seems incapable when he's doing a movie like this of being anybody but Will Smith. I don't, you know, whatever his name is, Henry Brogan or whatever, I'm not seeing Henry Brogan. I'm seeing Will Smith play Will Smith, do Will Smith stuff throughout the entire movie, and then when he becomes young Will Smith, he's just more sort of a more whimpering, you know, younger version of that Will Smith, sort of Will Smith before he was cool, basically. Yes, the motorcycle chase that Steve referenced is a highlight in the film, and I would say it's the only highlight in the film. Ang Lee, who has, you know, certainly done some really terrific action work in his time, Crouching Tiger for certain. I'd even go so far and put Hulk in that category as well. But beyond that motorcycle chase, you would think that for everyone that's involved with this thing, that there's got to be, you know, something to attract Lee other than just the tech. There's, like Steve said, there's very little probing discussion about the dangers of cloning. I think you could take any movie that's ever cloned anything, including parts of the Clonus Horror and Michael Bay's The Island, and you could find something of greater value in that discussion. What this film is eventually leading to, the action sequences are absolutely boring. Clive Owen, who is usually incapable of being this boring, I couldn't believe that he's the villain that we're all supposed to be, you know, on edge about. Mary Elizabeth Winstead is wasted in the film. This movie is just, for advanced as the tech is in this film, it's astounding just how generic everything surrounding it is in this movie. For 2 hours, just watching two bad Will Smith performances and a film that just seems incapable of going beyond saying, hey, look at this technology that we've perfected now, we spent $138 million on, and to give us nothing beyond that, other than, you know, a speech at the end and a late inning twist, that's a really no twist whatsoever. The entire enterprise is a complete and utter waste and failure.
Wow. All right. This thing has been kicking around for 20 years.
More.
Jeez.
Yeah. But in various, different writers, different actors, different directors. But yeah.
Right.
And we should mention in terms of tech that this is also shot in like this high frame rate thing, which I don't think I've seen it since The Hobbit, really. But this, the way they screened it for us, wasn't in 3D or in this high frame rate. I don't know if it's playing anywhere around here like this. But again, it's the same thing that we just said. Like, if you can't get the movie right, how it looks isn't really the most important thing.
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, if you can find it, give yourself something to distract yourself with a high frame rate if you can find it. But yeah, the 3D is pretty impressive, but who the hell knows?
Yeah.
I turned the motion smoothing off at home, and I remember that Hobbit screening, which I thought was just the most disastrous, distracting thing I could possibly imagine. So I went out of my way to make sure I didn't see it in that frame rate, frankly.
Yeah. We just found out that it is playing at the River East in that capacity.
Oh, okay.
All right. You guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes.
Eric and Steve are going to hang on, and we've got another movie to review, and then we'll talk about the box office as well as right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6, as it is every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. We got best opening scenes in movies we're going to talk about. We're also going to talk about some of the weirdest sports superstitions. And my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning, and it's a jokey time. Right now, we're wrapping up the things here with Eric Childress and Steve Procopi reviewing the new movies, and then we'll do the box office as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, tell us about the Addams Family.
Okay. Well, this is the first time we've gotten Charles Addams' famous family back on the big screen since 1993's Addams Family Values. But this time we're getting it in animated form. Charles Addams, it was originally a comic strip, and now we have a full-blown animated film with some really big names behind the voice work: Oscar Isaac as Gomez and Charlize Theron as Morticia. And as the movie begins, we meet the two of them on their wedding night, and things don't go right when basically the townsfolk drive them away, and they decide to settle in New Jersey. And many years later, we meet them again as their family has sprung forth. And we have Wednesday and Pugsley and all the people that we've come to know from this family. And we pick up exactly where they are in the current state of their living quarters. Basically, as far as the plot goes, Wednesday is set up to go to junior high, which is far more normal than her current living domains. We see how she attempts to shake things up there. Pugsley is on the verge of doing a sort of a rite of passage at home, and he is preparing for that with Gomez. But also lurking about in the community is a reality TV show host, voiced by Allison Janney, named Margot Needler, who is basically a fixer-upper. She she goes, comes into your house, and reinvents everything, remodels everything, gives you basically the perfect home. But she also has sort of nefarious plots, exactly what she wants to do with the community to sort of make it her sort of perfect ideal community, which seems like a really interesting thing to do in this day and age, except this movie doesn't seem to want to go beyond the sort of the really basic stuff to sort of draw in the family audience. You know, the Paramount's live-action versions with Raul Julia and Angelica Houston and Christina Ricci, you know, were PG-13 affairs, and they delved a little bit further into the macabre stuff. I thought the first movie kind of had that, hey, we're going to take this TV property and we're going to put it on the big screen, and isn't it going to be great? And it was just kind of okay. But then once they got the sort of introductions out of the way, they were able to really deliver something of really great value, no pun intended, with Adam's Family Values, which I still think is the high watermark of any of this, and I include the TV show as part of that. This one, it has an occasional chuckle here and there. I like the idea of the Allison Janney character, but I didn't feel that that went far enough. Wednesday being introduced into the high school and to take on sort of the mean girls in school never really goes anywhere. Her friendship with the daughter of the TV host also just kind of goes for the very basic, you know, she's going to turn her into a goth girl just like her. That doesn't really go very far. And it just seems very, the whole enterprise just seemed incredibly basic. And other than the New Jersey gag at the very beginning, there's very little sort of guffawing on my part. It's just not that funny. And it was a real disappointment because I think that both Isaac and Theron are doing some really good voice work. Chloe Grace Moretz is playing Wednesday. She's doing good voice work, but doesn't get much to do with the character as much as Christina Ricci did. I really did not like Nick Kroll's voice work as Uncle Fester. Every time he shows up, it just seems like he's just got something in his mouth the entire time, and he just seems a bit like drooling off screen. It was just really off-putting every time he spoke, and so that character ended up being twice as annoying as usual. I didn't quite see the value in doing this if you were just going to do it in such a simplistic, family-oriented way.
Okay. All right, Steve, what do you think?
I thought it was very funny. I mean, I had to actually look when I got home from seeing this to see what the rating was, because I thought some of the jokes were like very dark and borderline inappropriate, and I mean that in the best way. That's how they should be. These people aren't just, this family isn't just like playing Spook House. They're like genuine death mongers, and I love that aspect of it. Anytime they went somewhere I was not expecting, I was very happy. The first thing I noticed about the film was that, and it made me very happy, was that the characters looked almost exactly like that original comic strip version. I thought it, you know, I just like that idea that we're going back to the way they should be. And the one thing you realize almost immediately is that this is a story about like this family with this husband and wife that truly love each other. They care about each other's feelings, even if those feelings involve misery. And that's kind of the point. They support each other's lifestyles unconditionally. There's no judgment, and their marriage is stronger and better for it. And I was actually really, I think some of my favorite stuff was the stuff between Wednesday and this friend of hers, Parker, who actually is voiced by Elsie Fisher from Eighth Grade, and the way that their lifestyles kind of rub off on each other. Like whereas this girl Parker does become something of a goth girl, but then also Wednesday starts adding splashes of color to her usually black and white wardrobe, and it just freaks out her parents, and they are having their ideas about being embracive of their daughter's choices tested by these pink outfits that she adds. I mean, you know, much like the TV show, the film, you know, it sort of loves to show that contrast between the Addams Family and the North, quote-unquote, normal people. I don't know if that stuff works as well. I wasn't even that big a fan of what Allison Janney was doing here. I was much more involved in the more personal stories. But, like, there are some really nice voice cameos from Catherine O'Hara and Martin Short as Morticia's dead but very communicative parents. And Bette Midler plays Gomez's mother from the old country. And we should mention that the directors of this, Greg Tiernan, who did Sausage Party, and Conrad Vernon, who did Shrek 2 and Monsters vs. Aliens. I think they just have like a good sensibility about the tone this thing needs to hit, and especially in the humor, because there are messages about inclusion and acceptance, and this family are like kind of legendary outcasts, and so they're relevant as well as entertaining, and I think kids are going to dig it. The kids in the audience I saw with seem to dig it, but I also think it's safe for adults to go and see on their own. So, I dug it. I dug most of it, yeah.
I will say this. My parents went to see it over the weekend. They enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So, but I got to say, you mentioned Adam's Family Values, Eric. I love that movie.
Yeah, it's great.
It is so funny. And Christina Ricci, when she smiles, you know this? You know the scene?
Oh, yeah.
One of the great, I don't even know what to say. Paul Rudnick wrote that, man.
Every punchline that Raul Julia has in that movie, I remember I laughed so hard at that trailer that I thought all the best jokes were in that trailer, and they weren't.
No, it's a funny movie. It really is. It's a terrific movie. Okay. All right. So what do we got next week?
We got Zombieland, Maleficent.
Right? Zombieland.
Zombieland 2 and Maleficent 2.
Okay.
Mistress of Evil.
All right.
And Parasite finally opens in Chicago.
Oh, yes.
Which just
opens.
Broke a record this weekend. So.
Did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, people are loving that movie, man.
Yep.
Okay.
It's phenomenal.
All right, Steve, thanks, man.
All right, sure.
And Eric, you hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric's going to hang on, and we're going to come back and talk box office here on 720 WGN right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey-jokey time. And we just finished the Monday morning movie reviews, and now Eric's going to hang out with us, and we're going to talk box office. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay, so Joker, number one again. Did we think that was going to happen?
I thought it was going to happen. I did not think it was going to make as much as it did.
Yeah.
It goes without saying that this is quite a incredible drop for this movie that opened to $96 million last week and only dropped just under 43% this week. That's only been done for films that have grossed over $80 million in their opening weekend. This is only the 10th time that a film has dropped less than 44%.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. $192 million total.
Yeah. It seems inevitable that it's going to become the highest grossing film ever released in October, surpassing Gravity, as disappointing as that is. It seems destined like it is going to gross over $300 million.
That's amazing. Really is crazy. All right, number two, The Addams Family with $30 million. Those are good numbers.
Very, very good numbers. This one actually surprised me. I didn't know that there was going to be such an appetite for an Addams Family movie. I thought that this was going to be more in the sort of the Goosebumps range, because I had a feeling. I thought that, you know, the Hotel Transylvania movies exist. So which have been incredible hits, and I guess in lieu of not having a fourth one this year, people went to go see that.
Yeah, I guess it's the same. It's target audience. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Yeah. Wow, Gemini Man. How poorly are Will Smith's movies doing now?
They're not good. Yeah. You know, and people might want to, you know, might point to like Aladdin and Suicide Squad, but those films have built-in audiences.
Yeah.
People didn't go to those movies because of Will Smith, and Will Smith hasn't really had sort of a standalone Will Smith vehicle hit since Hancock in 2008.
Jeez.
You know, you think about like Focus and Concussion and you know, some of these other movies that he's done, which granted are not all, you know, big, you know, tentpole type movies.
Yeah.
But the whole point was that you could put Will Smith in those movies and people would show up.
Yeah.
That's clearly not the case. And I think more, you know, maybe we're discovering that it was the subject matter, the sci-fi subject matter that he was, you know, engaged in all these years that was the draw and not so much him.
Yeah. All right. Abominable, 6.1 million up to 48 million total.
Yeah, pretty much on his path to do somewhere in the 60 to 65 million range. Not particularly great. This one is still looking like a loser for Universal. It's only made another 60 million overseas as well, so it's just over like 100 some million worldwide.
Mm. Boy, Downton Abbey in the top five. Man, it's just killing it. 82.
Yeah,
it's up to 82 million.
And on the week that Ang Lee's Gemini Man absolutely fails, it's double trouble for him because now this movie, within the next few days, is going to become Focus Features' all-time domestic grosser, besting Brokeback Mountain.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Number six, Hustler, still doing good business.
Also killing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one's going to pass 100 million this week.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Number seven is Judy. 3.2 million, 14.9 total. Is that going to stick around? I mean, because there's going to be Oscar buzz, obviously, for.
Yeah, I don't think you'll be seeing it, pad out for the rest of the year, but certainly over the next couple of weeks, its core audience is clearly still coming out to see it. It always seemed it was on its pace to do somewhere around 20 to 25 million overall, and that seems to be exactly where it's headed right now. Roadside's done a pretty good job expanding the film. It's still only in about 1,600 theaters compared to others. But again, the audience is coming out for it, and you know that's sort of even a $25 million hit for Judy is going to go a long way in mounting the Zellweger campaign.
Yeah. Okay. It Chapter 2 coming in at number 8. How's that doing compared to the first one?
It's a hit. It's a hit for Warner Brothers. It didn't do nearly as well as the first film did, but this is, you know, a series. You combine them together, it's a billion-dollar series. So it did exactly what Warner Brothers wanted it to do. It's over $200 million. It's one of the most successful horror films of all time, highest grossing at least.
Okay. Number 9, Jexy.
Yeah, first mention of Jexy tonight.
Yeah, $3 million. it's like a vulgar version of Her, right?
Right. Yeah, it's Her, but from the writers of The Hangover and Bad Moms.
Yeah. Okay.
That says it all. 3.1 million.
Yeah, okay. And then number 10 is Ad Astra, 1.9 million, 47 million total. That's not good.
No, $120 million worldwide. This is a pretty, hefty. I mean, it's not Gemini Man numbers, but so at least seems Gemini Man will probably do worse budget wise than this film does. But this film's barely going to crack $50 million domestic. Not nearly what the Fox and James Gray were hoping for.
Wow. Okay. Wow. All right. Well, next week I guess Maleficent will be number one.
Yeah, I think so. Joker is doing so well, and I would if you were to press me on it, I would say Maleficent will come in. I don't think it's going to do nearly as well as the first movie did. I don't even think Zombieland is going to do as well as the first film did. I'm kind of curious to see where that's going to come in next week, too. That could come in third place. Joker could settle into second place,
yeah. And
Zombieland could come in third. I don't know how Neon is going to expand Parasite next week. It's expanding further, but it's still going to be in pretty limited release. But in only three theaters this weekend, it grossed $376,000.
Wow.
Yeah, that is it's the best per theater average since La La Land in 2016. It's the 18th best PTA of all time. Of movies that open in just three theaters, it's got the third best per theater average of all time behind Diving Bell and the Butterfly and Dreamgirls.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's impressive.
It is, very
that's impressive.
Much so.
I'm really looking forward to Zombieland.
I am too.
I can't wait to see it.
I'm hopeful.
Yeah. I mean, I think you got the same cast, you got the same writers, you got the same director.
Yeah.
The trailers are making me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And the Zoe Deutsch is already cracking me up. just in the trailer. She looks hilarious. Yeah. She's like she's going to be hilarious. I love it when Emma Stone goes, oh, my God, she's adorable.
Yeah, I mean, Ruben Fleischer has not exactly done anything I've liked since Zombieland. So hopefully he's going back to this well. And, you know, these are characters that I really liked the first time. And I've seen the movie multiple times since then. So I'm just hoping that, you know, we didn't get too much of a good thing back then, and that there's still a little bit left in these people because I really like them.
Yeah, me too. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And for those of us who are reviewing the movie, if there are surprise cameos in it, don't give them away.
Yeah, because one trailer's already done it.
Oh, they have?
The latest trailer has done a flashback cameo.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I remember when Zombieland came out, I couldn't believe it. I really seriously couldn't believe that critics gave away the fact that Bill Murray was in it.
Yeah.
I mean, I just went, what is wrong with you?
I think we kept it, when we reviewed it on the show, I think we purposely danced around it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think even at the end of the year when we did, like, best cameo on our list, I don't think we even said it then.
Yeah, no.
I think we just said that cameo in Zombieland.
Right. That's what we did. I mean, because, you know, I mean, it's just such a great, it was just such a huge and hilarious surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best cameos ever.
I think it might be the greatest cameo of all time.
It is right up there, man. It's definitely right up there. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, we'll see. Maybe is he going to come back again as a zombie in this one? Because, you know.
Well, that would be cool.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Because he does get killed in the...
not shot in the head.
No, exactly. So they do kill Bill Murray in the in the movie. So, anyway. All right, I'm looking forward to that. But the Maleficent, was that a big hit?
Huge hit.
Yeah?
Huge hit. Yeah, 220-some million, maybe more than that, actually, and a huge worldwide hit as well. It seems weird that they're releasing it in October. They've been trying to get this thing made for a while. They've been, you know, dancing around Angelina's schedule and stuff, and so they finally got it out, and I think this is the only place they had to put it, I think, so.
Okay. All right, and then also for the smaller theaters, you got Jojo Rabbit, which is coming out on Friday, and I'm really looking forward to Robert Eggers' follow-up to The Witch, The Lighthouse.
Right.
So those are. It's been a pretty interesting week next week, just in terms of content alone, and then we'll see how much money these movies make. So
totally.
All right, Eric. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks a lot, man.
All right, man. Take care.
Okay. You
there
too.
You go, Eric Childress. Everybody. He writes a piece about the box office as well, and every Sunday night/Monday morning he releases that, and we always talk about the box office, and we'll do it again next week. All right, we're going to take a quick break here on 720 WGN. And we're going to talk about some of the Pulp Fiction came out in 1994, right around this time. And we're going to talk about the best opening scenes in movies as well. And we will also remember Robert Forrester, who passed away over the weekend. All right, quick break here, and then we'll come back with more on 720 WGN.